What's up, everybody? Welcome to another edition of the Nine Circles Audio Thing. As you can guess, I am not Dan Kaplan. I am instead Chris Voss, and we beg your indulgence as we try out a couple of shorter segments for the podcast feed, focusing on albums or bands or any events that really kind of warrant a larger discussion than we would normally have on the website. So it's the morning of July 28th as I record this, but back on July 5th, we had the 30th anniversary of Slayer's South of Heaven. And I took the opportunity to sit down with our fearless editor-in-chief, Josh Stewart, to talk about the album, about the making of it a little bit, about the songs, but really, and more importantly for me, I think what it meant to us growing up in the 80s and acting as a bridge between the mainstream and hard rock that we were listening to at the time and how it kind of bridged us over to the more extreme metal that we've all come to know and love and embrace here on the site. So with that being said, I'm going to let the conversation take its course and just thank you for listening. Take care. So welcome back. This is the Nine Circles Audio Thing. I'm your host this week, Chris Voss, and with me is our illustrious editor-in-chief, Josh Stewart. Josh, how you doing, sir?
Good, man. How are you?
I am great.
Good.
And I am going to imagine that it is the two of us doing this because we are probably the two oldest people on the staff at Nine Circles and probably the only two people who were alive when this album came out on July 5th, 1988. And we are, of course, talking about The Great South of Heaven by Slayer. So let me just start asking you, Josh, since you are a little bit younger than me, how did you come to Slayer in the first place? Was it with South of Heaven? Was it with something else?
No. My initial with Slayer would have been Rain and Blood, and not when it came out. Probably, I'm going to say 89, and then maybe 90, I got into South of Heaven. And it was all a, typical high school buddy had a worn out, awful, terrible sounding cassette that we wore out over and over again of both of them.
Were you already listening to like heavy music at that point? Was Slayer the road in? So what was Josh listening to circa 1990 then at that point? What kind of music was on your radar?
Yeah, it was heavy, not like crazy ridiculous heavy, but it was heading that route. Some hair metal, of course, and classic rock, just all the other stuff. But yeah, I was into heavy metal by that point.
Yeah, for me, it was largely the same. So I didn't come to Slayer until I think Seasons in the Abyss was my first kind of exposure to it. I was very heavily into hair metal and stuff like that up until kind of the mid-80s. And kind of my intro into heavier music was probably Metallica when Master of Puppets came out. So it went to Metallica, then it went to Anthrax, then it went to Megadeth. And Slayer for me was always kind of the holdout. I was just not ready to kind of dip my toe into that water yet. I was still kind of a good Catholic kid. I was an altar boy. And it was just something about it that just was illicit to me at that point. But then the first time I heard Seasons of the Abyss, and probably the track that really hit me was probably Dead Skin Mask, which makes sense because it's got that riff that's very reminiscent of how South of Heaven starts out. That was it for me. I heard that. I'm like, oh, I got to check this out. And then I think the first Slayer album I bought was probably Decade of Aggression, the live album.
Mm-hmm. Good one.
Which to this day, I still think it's one of the best metal live albums I've ever heard. Just because at that time you're trying to stretch your buck. So it was like, oh, I can get all the music from the first four records,
Yep.
Get it on two discs and it sounds really good. And that was it. And slowly I kind of came back around and went down and went to South of Heaven, went to Rain and Blood, went to the others. But South of Heaven always had a warm place in my heart. And I know for you too, would I be lying if I said it was one of your favorites?
It is. It is my favorite. I'm going to have to go out on a limb and say it's my number one Slayer album. Even though, like you said earlier, my toe was dipped by Rain and Blood, but out of all the albums, South of Heaven's my favorite.
So here's how it was explained to me. Tell me if you heard something similar or what your take on it was. I'd always been told by people who were in the know, because even back in the 80s, there were a bunch of elitist metalheads that knew the right way of things, that Rain and Blood was the super fast aggression, and South of Heaven was the slow, moodier, contemplative one, and then Seasons in the Abyss was the marriage of the two, was how it was always explained to me.
Yeah,
and I love both of those albums. I love Rain and Blood. I think the thing that drew me to South of Heaven was just there are some faster tracks on it, and we'll probably have to take a couple minutes to go through all the tracks at some point in this conversation. But for me, that just kind of slowing down allowed me to kind of appreciate what was going on a little bit more, especially at that time, than Rain and Blood did, which was just so fast and relentless. Even to this day, I'll be honest, and you know, there's still things that fly by that I'm like, oh, crap, I don't remember that from that album, even though now I've heard it hundreds upon hundreds of times. There's just something about the pace and the measuredness of South of Heaven that just really, really appeals to me.
Yeah, it's all about pacing for me as well. It kind of had a more, I don't know, death metal vibe, maybe. You know, slow, murky death metal vibe. But I had listened to Rain and Blood, and again, the buddy with the, you know, with the beat up cassette tape, which we wore out. At that time, you know, I was starting to look for the more extreme. There's got to be something heavier. There's got to be this. There's got to be that. And Rain and Blood was that. But then we listened to it so many times that by the time I finally got my hands on South of Heaven, it was like, wait a minute. This is what I was missing from the last one. I gotta say, listening back on it, I mean, even today I was listening to it on the way home, and it sounds just as good and just as relevant today as it ever did.
Oh yeah, you know, it's funny, I was doing the same thing, listening to it probably through most of the weekend, and it's still, there are moments that kind of, because you focus on certain things, I think everybody focuses especially on that first half of the album, because it's just so classic, right? From South of Heaven right to Mandatory Suicide. So I was driving to work today and I was listening to it, and Ghosts of War came on. And it's just one of the songs that always, as much as I love the album, it's the one that always kind of takes me by surprise for a second. And it has that minute in the beginning before the song starts proper. You get the riffs and kind of the furious intro, but it sounds like it's coming from like a tin can, or it's coming from really far away. And then about a minute later, it just kind of kicks right in your face and just goes kind of full throttle with the full production. And I'm shocked to that to this day. I haven't heard this album for, you know, so many years now at this point that I completely forgot about that. That Ghosts of War kind of starts off, you know, with this little kind of audio production trick before it goes right in your face. So there's still a lot of surprises, I think, to be had on the record.
Absolutely. Well, and that too, you know, listening to this thing early on, and then, you know, having listened to it all these many years later, you know, any album that you can listen to 30 years on and still find stuff, I mean, hey, obviously that's a great album.
Yep. No, absolutely. So I did a little digging, did a bunch of online looking up stuff today. So had a couple of things gonna kind of run through, and maybe we can talk a little bit about some of this stuff. So one of the things that we talked about earlier in the Nine Circles kind of group chat, we all kind of get together, one of the things that came up was the divide, the huge divide between Kerry King and Jeff Hanneman. particularly around the soloing. So I had to be, you know, one of the things I never thought about was, especially on the production of South of Heaven, they split the solos very hard. They pan very hard left, right. So when you're listening, you'll hear one solo really hard right, and you'll hear one solo really hard left. And I had always been partial to the left solos, which, thank God, it took a while to dig up, but that is definitely Jeff Hanneman on the left-hand side and Kerry King on the right-hand side. And one of the things that kind of looked through with the album is this is largely a Jeff Hanneman album.
Yes.
He has the majority of the music written for this. He's definitely got the majority of the interesting and well-fleshed-out solos on this. Kerry King kind of doesn't like the album, and I gotta wonder why. What's your thought on what's your thought on this being a Hanneman album and Kerry King's virtues or lack of as a solo player on this thing?
Well, that's like I said earlier today. I've always kind of just imagined that it was just Hanneman, period, and that, you know, Kerry wasn't even on it. But obviously that's not the case. Hanneman, I think, let's see, King, he got married or something right around this album and was kind of absent, I believe. And so Hanneman did do a lot of the writing for it. And I mean, it shows, you know, King's soloing and leads and stuff, they're just way fast, and that's about all you get. Hanneman's is, you know, extremely thought out, a little bit slower, a little bit more to it. So yeah, I like the Hanneman side of things. I mean, I say all that, but, you know, obviously a Slayer without Kerry King, it would be a little empty. But
yeah, and, you know, not to bag on King too much, but King, so he has a couple of co-writing credits, but those co-writing credits are on Silent Scream, Mandatory Suicide, and Ghosts of War. So I mean, I'm not a huge, if I have to point to a weak point of the album, it's probably Ghosts of War. But goddamn, Silent Scream and Mandatory Suicide are probably two of my favorite tracks on the album, you know, so I have to give them a little bit of credit. So yeah, so reading through Hanneman kind of really diving into the music, and the first time that Tom Araya really kind of taken over a lot of the lyric writing as well. So this is probably the first album that King doesn't have the heavy hand in, and I got to wonder if that's part of the reason why I like it as much as I do.
Well, I mean, it wasn't all about Satan and hell and, you know, hellfire and brimstone. It's about awful world history, you know? And I mean, it's you can read these lyrics, and they're scarier than anything that you'd read about Satan or whatever.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that really, and I recall vividly when I started reading the lyrics as a kid, it was the same thing with Death. Death was another one of those bands, and we got to talk about Death at some point on this show.
Yes.
Death is one of those bands I was always, as a kid, kind of terrified to listen to, because, oh, there's probably some really heavy stuff there that, you know, as a young Christian kid, I didn't want to get into. And then when I finally kind of caved in and bought a Death record, I think it might have been Spiritual Healing was my first one, and read through the lyrics, Chuck Schuldiner was talking about anything other than what I had imagined in my kind of young brain. And that was the same thing when I finally started reading the Slayer lyrics, especially with this South of Heaven, you know, album cover and song. Until you really read the lyrics, your impression's probably going to be this is about Satan and the devil, and then you start to read it and it's really not about that at all.
Yeah.
Which was pretty surprising. And then yeah, right to your point, Ghost of War and you know, a lot of those other songs are about anything other than Satanism, and I think that's something to the positive for this record.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I mean, you know, in this day and age, I mean, the whole Satan thing is, yeah, we still use it, but it's, you know, I mean, it's so played out. But back then, you know, that was, I mean, you take this, just this album cover alone, and kid goes and buys it and brings it home, and better not let mom see that one. You know?
Yeah, no, this was probably well hidden until I was a little bit older and was finally able to convince my mother this wasn't the work of the devil. Yeah. If anything.
Yeah.
So huge input from Hanneman and Araya. King kind of off the beaten path there, getting married. The other interesting thing that I read that surprised me, quite frankly, was Lombardo didn't really like the record either, at least from what I read. And that surprises me more, because I was thinking through this today. If I have to have an MVP for the record, as great as Hanneman is with the riffs that he comes out, for me, it's Lombardo. Because this is the album for me where, as great as he is on Rain and Blood, and he's amazing there, he sounds better here. The production on the drums is enormous. And this is really the album where, for me, it kind of shows his ability to be restrained and still just be complete throat grabbing, full throttle, aggressive at the same time. He has this knack of just kind of, if the riff is going, at this kind of fast speed, he's going to go in halftime just to add that menace. If the riff is going really slow, he's going to double time it just to kind of get that rush of adrenaline on the song. And I think here, because there's a lot more kind of dynamics between faster tempo pieces and slower tempo pieces, Lombardo's ability to kind of shine is that much more spotlighted, as opposed to something like Rain and Blood, where it's just so fast and so aggressive and everybody is going 100 miles an hour and, everyone is just hitting that same point. You get a lot more sense of space here and a lot more ability to see stuff like, oh shit, Kerry King solos don't sound all that great. And, and Hanneman can really fucking write a riff. And, especially with Lombardo knows when to pick his moment to freaking blow your brains out on this album.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the drumming on this thing is ridiculous. I mean, it is ridiculous. I think a lot of what he does on this, like you say, yeah, MVP for sure, because he pushes this thing when it needs pushing, he does it. When he needs to lay off a little bit, he knows exactly when to do what. So yeah, the first time I ever read that Lombardo wasn't a fan of this album either, I'm like you, man. I was shocked, because this is one of, if not the best of his moments, in my opinion, with Slayer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the thing that made me realize this is one of the greatest drummers ever. As great as Rain and Blood is, it was South of Heaven that really brought me into the Lombardo kind of fold for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Rain and Blood, when I look back on these two, Rain and Blood, I like it because it fed what I was needing at the time, as far as, okay, it's more extreme, it's fast all the time, 100%. But I love South of Heaven because it takes advantage of every second of the record. Slow, fast, perfect mix, perfect combination.
Oh, yeah. So with that being said, why don't we take a quick couple of minutes and just kind of go through the tracks and just kind of shoot some thoughts out on it. So first one, South of Heaven.
Amazing intro. Oh, my God. That's one of the best intros on a metal album ever.
Is there a better opening song on a Slayer album? I think this is the best opening. I mean, Angel of Death is fantastic, but when I think of Angel of Death, I think of the bridge. I think of that, insane bridge that Public Enemy later sampled, and I mean, that's like the riff. When I think of South of Heaven, I think of South of Heaven. I think of that great harmonized riff that they play in the beginning before it then kind of shifts gears and goes into that kind of crushing groove, with the verses.
Yeah, it set the opening few seconds of this thing sets the tone for the whole album. I mean, I didn't even realize it then, but listening back, and that was one thing that really caught me listening back to this thing over the past couple of weeks. Through, if you go all the way through it a couple times, you see just how much South of Heaven sets the tone immediately.
All right, so South of Heaven, Silent Scream next, kind of popping up the pace, going much more aggressive in your face with the second song. Again, this is probably, with Mandatory Suicide, this might be my favorite song on the album.
Yeah, I like it. It's not my all-time favorite, because it was at the time it was a little bit too close to Rain and Blood, but it was a nice counterpoint to the opener.
Yeah. Live Undead is next, track three. What do we think?
I dig it. I mean, I'll probably say that for every song, But because I mean, there's no skippers here. I mean, it's good. Definitely, it's good. Again, not my favorite, but it fits right in.
So let's save the podcast listeners a couple of minutes, yeah, because I'm in the same boat where I can probably say that for anything. For me, really, 1 to 5, South of Heaven, Silent Scream, Live Undead, Behind the Crooked Cross, Mandatory Suicide. To me, that's an impeccable side A. You know, if we're still talking about the days of when you're flipping cassettes and flipping LPs, there may not be a stronger side A that I can kind of readily think to mind that came out around 1988.
Yeah, no, definitely not. That opening side is just amazing. And then, of course, you flip it over and you get side two of this just killer. But for me, as good as South of Heaven sets the tone and as good as Mandatory Suicide is, and once you hear it, you never can forget it. It never comes out of you. It's an earworm. Behind the Crooked Cross has always been one of my favorites off this album.
Oh, that's such a great song.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Man.
So moving on to side two, Ghosts of War, Read Between the Lies, Cleanse the Soul, Dissident Aggressor, Spill the Blood. I mean, even now, as much as I love, and if we have to kind of have some quibbles with a classic album that we both love dearly, I love Dissident Aggressor. I think it's a great cover. I have a weird, it breaks the scope of the album for me a little bit, though, if I'm going to be completely honest.
Well, and I could definitely see that. However, to me, I love this cover. And being that it was a little bit slower, again, away from Rain and Blood, and the fact that I was listening to a little bit of Judas Priest around this same time, I love it. I wouldn't have the album any other way. I love their cover. I think it's great.
So yeah, it's a small quibble. I love the song. I think it's a great cover. Just when you're going through, you know, Cleanse the Soul to Spill the Blood, it's a small kind of hit to me. It doesn't make me love the album any less, but it just kind of, for me, roughens that second half sequence a little bit.
Yeah, I have always thought that should have been the last track. Instead of in between, I mean, my God, Spill the Blood. Come on, man.
But then at the same time, right? Spill the Blood is such a great last track.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is. You're right. I agree.
How do you not make that the final track? I mean, it's just such a, that is another killer one. So at this point, I don't have a lot much else to say about the album, except, again, if I'm being honest, and I'm going through the Pantheon of Slayer records, this one holds my top spot. I'm not going to say it's a whopping, you know, number one versus a distant number two, which for me is probably Rain and Blood. I think they're fairly close, but this is the one that's always got my heart, definitely.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, no doubt whatsoever. And, you know, here's the thing about it. 88 was a killer year. I mean, you had Danzig's self-titled album. You had Maiden's Seventh Son of a Seventh Son, Death's Leprosy. There was all these just ridiculously good albums, and it's funny. God, 30 years. Wow.
It's 30 years. Goddamn, are we old,
oh,
sir.
Oh, my Lord. But, I mean, it's funny looking back 30 years in the past. And I mean, to me, and probably you as well, this album shaped a lot of my metal comeuppance, I guess you'd say. And had it been, you know, had this album been Death's Leprosy or something else from that year, it could have been, I mean, I could have had a total different trajectory.
Oh, yeah. So just looking at a few of the other albums that came out in 88, right? So Metallica's Injustice for All, which is a huge touchstone in my life. Megadeth, So Far, So Good, So What, Anthrax, State of Euphoria, Testament's The New Order. This is from some Revolver mag that came out about South of Heaven. Death Angels, Frolic in the Park, Violence's Eternal Nightmare, Flotsam and Jetsam's No Place for Disgrace, Nuclear Assault, Survive. I mean, there were some killer stuff that was coming out, but it was really Slayer and it was really this that kind of made me more than anything else. Even with the Metallica and Megadeth, I was still very heavily into the hair and the glam metal, whatever you want to call it. But Slayer was the one that really kind of turned me, I don't want to say turned me off to it, because one of the great things about music is that you can always come back to it with a different frame of reference and find something to love about again. And I definitely have done that with hair metal and glam metal and the metal of my youth. But Slayer at the time was the band, and South of Heaven was the album that made me go, yeah, no, I need to travel that left-hand path. I need to start looking at stuff that's a little heavier, a little faster, a little angrier, a little meaner. And I think that more than anything else is what started bringing me to kind of death metal and everything that then kind of exploded from there.
There's no doubt in my mind
that, so screw you, Kerry King and Dave Lombardo, this album is just fine.
Right. Doesn't need a thing.
Yeah, what are you guys talking about? You crazy. So I think that'll probably wrap it up. We want to just do a couple of these shorter kind of one-off episodes every now and again, give a little bit more content into the podcast feed, so expect to see Josh and myself or others kind of jumping in, talking about different topics, whether it's an album or a genre or something else. I figure, though, Josh, before we left, since there is a ton of shit going on in terms of music in July, as we're recording this, so July 5th was the anniversary of the album, but it's July 16th. July has been an insane month for new releases. So what are you listening to right now? What in July has been turning you on?
God, I mean, there's just so much stuff. The Lion's Daughter, obviously, that's been kicking it for me. Immortal, still.
That album is great.
Oh, man, still, God, I mean, I can't get enough of that one.
What else? Anything else striking you?
You're gonna get me for this one, and I cannot help myself, but Hectabomb. I'm sorry, but I...
At least you said the album name right. I know some other idiot that mangled it on the last audio podcast.
No, that was... Yeah. So when I heard... I'm sorry. When I heard Hectabomb, I said, oh, man, that is great. I'm gonna have to get him on that one sometime later.
Yeah,
that's a killer album. That is amazing. Imperial Triumphant.
Yeah, I'm still diving into that. There's so much to kind of take apart with that, and I think that's something that's going to have to be talked about a lot more at some point, because it's such a challenging and upfront and dynamic record. There's so much to pull apart on that sucker.
Yes, yeah, it's I can't imagine being Anton and having to try to dive into that as a review, because just listening to it to pull that profile together, I was looking for an angle in. He made it look easy the way he approached it, with all the, you know, talking about New York and all that stuff. But and it was a great review, by the way. But
dude nailed it, absolutely.
No kidding. But man, I can't even imagine having to put words together for that album.
So I'm checking through our list here. For me, I mean, right now, and I feel almost ashamed that it's going to sound so mainstream, but there's this real obscure band you may have heard about called Deaf Heaven.
Yeah, I think I heard of them.
Yeah, I've been listening to that thing nonstop. I have lots of thoughts on that, all for the most part positive. I just wrote about last week, and if you guys haven't given it a chance, because I mean, really, Deaf Heaven seemed to kind of occupy the music discourse, at least in the metal community, last week. But a lot of other great stuff came out, including the second part of the Automata album by Between the Barry and Me. So Automata 2 came out, and it's a stronger record than the first half. So a lot of people talking about, you know, the impact of splitting the album in two, and whether that was a help or a hindrance. A lot of times the back half of an album can be lost in the shuffle, especially after a couple of listenings. Splitting it apart, at least for me, really brought to light how great and how strong the second half of that album is. So that's something I've been listening to nonstop. I'll play the Future Game as well. And when it comes out, highly recommend Karada's debut album, Salt.
So good.
Yeah, I'm still trying to kind of get my head around it, but it like Imperial Triumphant, there's a lot there to kind of take apart musically and conceptually. It's a killer album. And then if you're just looking for some fun, crazy, you know what? I don't really want to think too much. I just want to have some fun. I think I mentioned it on Receiving the Eucharist, but man, the Antichrist Imperium, Volume 2, every tongue shall do something or other, and my brain's hitting me right now, every tongue shall praise Satan. Goddamn, that is a fun, rocking little album.
Totally not.
I had nothing to say about it, man.
I mean, totally not what I expected going into it, but out of the backside of it, it was so good. So good. And there's so much going on that thing, too.
Yeah, black metal right now in the last month or so has had some real freaking highlights. And I'm especially not talking about our album of the month for June. There's a lot more out there that is really, really kicking ass. So if you have not checked out any of those albums, highly recommend you do so. I think at that point that'll do it for us. So for Nine Circles, I am Chris Voss, with me
Josh Stewart,
and we will see you all next time. Thank you very much.
See ya.
All right. Thanks to Josh Stewart for jumping on the call and sharing his thoughts on such a monumental album. A couple of last-minute cleanup items. www.ninecircles.co is the website where you can find our reviews, interviews, essays, and the like. Also on facebook.com/ninecirclesblog. You can find us on Twitter, where our handle is @_ninecircles. You can also subscribe to this podcast if you like it. We are on all of the services, including Apple Music, Spotify, TuneIn, Google Play, Stitcher, probably a bunch of others that I can't remember at the moment. If you like what you heard, like us, subscribe, rate, review, please. We appreciate it. We're trying to bring more content, more varied content, trying to do a couple of new things. Want to get some audience interaction involved at some point. So we'll keep trying out things like this, and hopefully you'll keep supporting us. If you want to email us, you can go to 9circlesblog@gmail.com. Feel free to rant, rave, or otherwise pontificate on what we got right, what we got wrong. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably heard me get a lot of things wrong. But that's okay. This is a first time, and we'll keep experimenting and trying out new stuff. So that'll do for now. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen, and we will talk to you next time. Bye.